But it turns out the worst offender.
Some of these people wait 10, 15, 20 minutes, and that's very disrespectful to people who show up.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to order for Thursday, May 14th. We have a couple, three members down in revenue. They've got bills being heard right now, so they're hoping that they'll move quickly out of the Revenue Committee and someplace else. But we won't hold our breath how long they will be. But I appreciate those that have come to offer testimony today. So today we're holding an informational meeting regarding seismic upgrades to schools and emergency response infrastructure. So the first two people, Lynn from Business, well, is it Business Oregon, Oregon Business Development? What is it, Lynn?
We have so many names.
I know. And Ian, who's the state geologist. So thank you very much for coming and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the director of the Infrastructure Finance Division of Business Oregon.
Business Oregon, thank you.
Some of you may recall that in January 2014, the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program was transferred to the Business Development Department. And along with that came the promise in the spring of 2015, $30 million for grants for both emergency services buildings and schools. So during the spring and summer of 2014, we did outreach sessions and workshops statewide to get people engaged with the process and understand what was really available. In early fall, we received applications. In fall, then, we rated the applications and reviewed them with a statutorily described seismic advisory committee to the program. The committee recommended awardees, and in December, we awarded or announced those awardees. We also prepared the contracts and drafted them so that when the bond sale proceeds became available, that we could write those contracts, because it was all important that the schools get a contract so they could plan for the summer vacation season and get the construction done. And at this point in time, I think all but one of those contracts is signed, so everybody is well on their way to, you know, having projects done by the end of summer. In our request for proposals, we received applications for $45 million for the $15 million that was available. We did then award funding for 13 school buildings and 22 emergency service buildings for $14 million and $15 million respectively. I think the list of our projects is posted for you, but if it's not, I can certainly get that for you without hesitation. And the one thing I would want to point out about related to the awards we made, 76% of the dollars went to rural parts of the state, and 83% of the projects went to the rural parts of the state. As you're probably fully aware, the governor's budget has $100 million of geo bond request. That would be $70 million in, under Constitutional Article 11M for schools, and $30 million for emergency service buildings under the Article 11N. And no surprise, you're also equally aware that there are numerous other funding proposals out there related to the program. Our current loan limit is $1.5 million. That was established by the advisory committee. And so with the $100 million, we would expect to do 60 more schools and between 20 and 40 emergency service buildings, and I put a broad range on that because we've had a lot of applications from rural fire districts that want to upgrade their building, and they usually don't take a whole lot of money. Candidly, given the preference and the amount of money, we would like to emphasize hospitals applying for the grants. Hospitals are a bit of a unique situation because many of them have rebuilt over the course of the years. Some with old building components, some with new. So if we get the whole building up to a current seismic standard, that would be excellent. And of course, they are buildings that are crucial in the event of an event. And so we would like to emphasize that. I think our program is gaining momentum. I can tell you that last summer we had triple the attendance of previous workshop attendance. I would expect, because I think the program has gained a solid, good reputation, that we will have triple the attendance again this year. And I don't see any reservations in saying I'm very confident that if provided $100 million, we'll be able to commit that readily. With that, I would conclude my testimony, obviously, unless you have some additional questions about specific aspects of the program.
I do have a couple questions. So,
sure.
I was involved in a conversation a couple of days ago with several people from several different school districts. And one of the comments that was made that in some cases, given the condition and age of these schools, the school ought to be replaced versus this retrofit or fitting it for earthquake. And so I'm trying to understand in your process.
Okay.
So what's the requirement engineering? I mean, what's the requirement from a standpoint of where that line is, that it's worth, even though the community may want at that point, worth putting the money into that versus a new building?
Yes, Chair, members of the committee. What we use is a tool called a benefit cost analysis model. It's a federally recognized algorithm that's very complicated. I couldn't begin to explain it to you. But it's used by FEMA, it's used by local emergency service providers when they're trying to assess exactly that, is it worth making the investment or not. Mm-hmm. In our particular case, what we do is provide input to that model that identifies the location of the building, and that's, you know, a statewide map that indicates flood zones, fault lines, basic geographic conditions. In addition to that, then the specific soil type that the building is built upon, the structure type, whether it's masonry, unreinforced masonry, wood frame, steel, whatever it might be, the year that it's built, the replacement value, the contents value, and then occupancy, to what degree is that building occupied by how many people for what percentage of the day.
Sure.
All of that comes out of that model with a number. And that number is an indicator of to the degree it's worth replacing that building or forgetting it. So in our most recent round, the highest rated buildings had probably a 7-to-1 ratio in the outcome. The lowest rated buildings had probably 1.5-to-1, meaning that for every dollar you put in, you're saving by virtue of fixing the building, you know, the expense of having to replace it at a later date. Mm-hmm. So that's the determiner that we use, that this is a good decision or this is a bad decision. Certainly emotion, mm-hmm. historic value enters into it in many cases. But as we've suggested, if it's that emotionally important to the community and of that greater historic value, how about building a new school and turning that into the local community center, art center, and using a different resource to rehabilitate it rather than our grant program.
But your program can't be used for building new schools or new buildings?
Chair, that's correct. It's not permitted by virtue of the constitutional provision. It must be for rehabilitation of an existing facility.
Any other questions at this point, Brian? Doesn't look like it. Ian?
Good morning, or good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the interim state geologist and director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to tell you about the statewide seismic needs assessment program that was carried out in 2006 and 2007 as supporting information for the seismic rehabilitation grant program. So if you don't mind, I'm a geologist, I have to have slides, so have a couple pictures here.
We appreciate that.
First off, a little bit of history. The statewide seismic needs assessment was part of a package of legislation that enabled the seismic rehabilitation grant program, specifically Senate Bill 2 in 2005, which directed DOGAMI to prepare a statewide assessment of the seismic resistance of school buildings, public school buildings, and critical facilities. And then there were also was also legislation that allowed the bonding and enabled the seismic rehabilitation grant program. So we had basically a one biennium task to go out and collect this information and provide them with a basis for their evaluations. So the first step in this was to actually find all of these buildings, and it was much harder than you might expect. There were no comprehensive lists of any of these kinds of facilities available, and we actually ended up doing a lot of detective work with the phone directory, air photos, calling people up and eventually pulled together a database of over 3,000 buildings that needed to be evaluated. Some of the parameters here, the legislation required us to look at buildings or school buildings with an occupancy over 250 students. Mm-hmm. We actually dipped well below that in many communities. Our target was to have 90% of the students in any particular district in buildings that were covered. And so particularly for small rural districts, we had to go to much smaller schools to try to meet that goal. And so we ended up, you know, as you can see here, with over 2,000 school buildings to look at. One other thing to keep in mind when we're talking about all these numbers is that these are individual buildings. And so many schools will have 5-6 individual structures that have different structural systems, and so they all need to be evaluated separately. So the evaluations were done with FEMA's rapid visual screening manual. It's called FEMA 154, and this is a procedure that FEMA has perfected that is designed to allow a trained inspector to very quickly make an assessment of the relative seismic risk of a building. And it's very important to note that it's a screening tool, and it's basically designed to say, is this a building that needs further investigation, or is it a building that we don't have to worry about? And so the kind of information that goes into this is what we call a sidewalk survey. So we send the screener out to the building, and he walks around the outside of the building and gleans what he can about the seismic or the structural system from that, enters that data into a table, and that spits out an answer. And to give you an idea as to the level of detail, we spend about $200 a school collecting this information. So 15, 20 minutes, half an hour on the ground, and that's kind of it. So keep that in mind, that the quality of information is sort of related to how much you spent on it. And so we would put together a risk score, and there's all sorts of things that go into the risk score, the soil type, the structural type of the building, whether it's unreinforced masonry, steel, all these other kinds of characteristics. Is it three stories? Is it two stories? Does it have irregularities in the shape? All those pieces go into this formula, which then spits out a collapse potential value. We made a conscious choice when we did this to always be as conservative as possible with those choices. So in many cases, you walk up to a school building, you don't know whether it's an unreinforced masonry building or a reinforced masonry building or a wood frame building with brick veneer. And so the screeners would record all three of those possibilities. And then we would do the calculation with all three of those, and we would pick the set of values that gave us the worst score, because we wanted to not have any surprises in that direction. So many of the buildings that have been ranked with very high potential may actually not be as bad as they seem, but we would prefer to err in that direction than in the other. So very briefly, here's some of the results broken down by the types of buildings. And so you can see that for K through 12 schools, we're close to 50% statewide that are in the very high or high category, which means they need to be looked at. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to collapse, doesn't necessarily mean they need retrofit, but they have to be looked at. And community colleges are, in fact, more than 50%. When we look at the critical facilities, actually the situation is much better. For the most part, they're about 25% or so in that category that needs to be evaluated. And so they're a little bit less of a concern, and of course there's far fewer of them than there are of the schools. So the results of these surveys have been posted on our website since 2007. You can go there and download the entire database that has everything in it that we've done, or you can pick a particular county or a particular school district and home in on a particular school and get a report. So you can see here an example of the report sheet for the Baker High School. It's got all the score factors that we collected. It's got an aerial photo of the building that identifies which building you're actually talking about. In this case, there's A through F, so there's six buildings on the site. It has the score, and it also has contact information, address information. So this kind of information is readily available to the public through our website. I just wanted to take a quick look at the geography of the risk. with these buildings, because as we've heard earlier, that there's was a focus in this last round on rural schools, and I think that's quite appropriate. If you take a look at the number, the majority of schools, or pardon me, the majority of counties that have more than half of their schools in the high-risk categories are in eastern Oregon or rural counties in the coast, in the coast or southern Oregon. So there's really kind of a concentration of that risk in counties that are more hard-pressed to pay for it. So I think it's appropriate that they're trying to focus on those counties. So at the request of some of the legislative staff, we actually sat down and tried to answer the question, how has this situation changed as a result of the grant program? And so we took the cumulative information from all of the grants that have been awarded, compared that to the original database to try to calculate what percentage of buildings had been fixed. And so, as you can see from the table here, not very many. When you're starting out with, you know, hundreds, fixing a half a dozen doesn't make a whole bunch of difference. You have to take this answer with a bit of caution, though, because we know that lots of school districts have retrofit their schools without going through the grant program. Portland, for example, has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on that. And we have not been able to, particularly in the time involved here in putting this answer together, we've not been able to try to evaluate how many of those buildings have been retrofit. But my guess is that no more than 10% of any of these buildings have been retrofit overall. So we've still got a very long way to go.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. So we don't have a system set up after going through the work to evaluate and categorize and put them on the web. We don't have a system where districts need to report back when they've done some work so that that information can be updated.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, this slide will address that very question.
Okay.
So in 2012, Senate Bill 1566 required school districts to complete a seismic report card that described what actions they had taken to retrofit or replace schools, and to send that report card to Dogami, and we post those on our websites. So we have there's 221 districts statewide, and we've received 230 of those seismic reports. Many districts have submitted more than one because they've had, for instance, like Portland, every year they do more retrofit. But basically, they were supposed to report on their retrofit from 2007 up to 2012, and then every year after that, if they have made any changes, then they're supposed to submit another report. As I said, there's 230 of those. We have not gone through those and tried to cross-reference those with the original survey database to try to make that comprehensive.
Okay. And just a quick follow-up. And you've done a great job. I've had like four questions, but I held off, and on the next slide you answered. So you're doing great. But and maybe Len answered this before I walked in. On the funding program, the grants, was that a straight grant or was it a matching grant? How did we handle that, or was it a combination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, it is a straight grant. There's no match obligation, but the practical reality is, for a small, probably rural school district that isn't very affluent and has a relatively small building, the $1.5 million usually does the upgrade in and of itself. And because of the economy of the community, they probably don't have a lot to match. On the other hand, if you have a larger school district, more urban, larger building, the $1.5 million is not going to make a full upgrade, and by virtue of necessity, they will have to match it to a degree to get a complete project. We don't fund partial projects. We only fund complete projects.
Okay. Good. Good information. Thanks.
Okay. Very good. Chair Lively, members of the committee, that's my last slide. So I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Mr. Chair, if I could just footnote and comment to Ian.
Sure.
To date, the grant program has done 37 schools, or at least 37 are both completed and in progress, will be done by the end of the summer. The $100 million request addresses 60 additional. So we're finally in a position, at least advocates are suggesting, to do something significant finally.
Further questions? So maybe you could help me understand. So what's, so you went through and did the list, the walk-bys, and developed these for the risk assessment. Mm-hmm. So what, I assume the districts then have to do whatever work it takes to get it past that to understand what the real risk is and then what the amount of cost might be. So do you have some idea of what that entails? I mean, is this, so how do they reach that next point based on, so you provide information that says they may be at risk, mm-hmm. but obviously it's only based on certain factors.
As part of our working with the Senate Bill 33 task force to try to help them come up with some recommendations and some values on that, we actually looked into the cost of the next step of investigation, okay. in which case you would have an engineer come in, look through the plans, actually do a detailed evaluation of the structural system and make recommendations and estimate costs. And it's a little hard, you know, it depends on the size of the building and all those kinds of things, but you're looking in the $3,000 to $8,000 a building range to have that evaluation done.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I might add, this last competition that we had, we made an allowance in the grant proposals for $5,000 towards that expense, mm-hmm. should they be successful. Before that wasn't a provision, and it frankly, it's a bit of an incentive to folks to make the effort, because this is a voluntary program. There's no obligation whatsoever. So recognizing that there may be a reimbursement for their advanced mm-hmm. expense, I think encourage people to apply.
That's great. Very good. Any further questions from any member of the committee? No? Thank you very much.
Certainly.
So, Senator Boquist, do you wish to come and engage in any conversation with us?
You can go through your list, I'll wait.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm here to listen to.
Okay, thanks a lot. Jay, I think you're up next.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I've brought in a hard copy, so since it hasn't been posted, I'm just going to quickly read through it and then be available for additional comments. In testifying today on the seismic upgrades to schools and emergency response structures, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, OSPAC, fully supports increasing the level of funding to support the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, or SRGP. OSPAC has recommended a funding increase to $200 million for this program for a number of years, and we support this level similar to that recommended by Senate President Peter Courtney and the Oregon Resilience Task Force. We ask that no matter what level of funding increase, that the distribution of these funds be appropriately shared between schools and emergency response facilities and hospitals based on the expert judgment of the Infrastructure Finance Authority and the SRGP Advisory Committee. We urge that this funding increase be sustained to help meet the original intent and timeline approved by Oregon voters in 2002. We support the ability of the SRGP Advisory Committee to make informed decisions regarding updating the administrative rules when considering increasing the project cap from the current $1.5 million if increased funding is approved. OSPAC also supports the attempt to administer the SRGP to best provide geographical distribution across the state and to help rural communities that may have concentrations of seismic risk and with minimal technical capacity to participate. We support higher seismic retrofit standards for schools to ensure operability after the earthquake so that these facilities remain in service for their communities. And finally, OSPAC continues to promote the ability for the few remaining coastal schools that are inside of the tsunami inundation line to have some ability to benefit from this statewide program to help communities relocate their students outside of the tsunami hazard zone. Thank you for your continued work to improve Oregon's seismic resilience.
Thank you. Questions for Jane? So I might have a question. I don't know if this is in your area or not, or maybe your committee's talked about it, but so we talk about schools and then next is hospitals, and I'm trying to understand if there's some, again, from priority, since we have limited funds, where they're going. If there's some attempt, when you look at a community, about the potential impact, that in some cases that hospital might be at a higher risk or more important to sustain than even in, well, I'm not discounting schools, even the schools, when you look at the ability to recover from any kind of emergency.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you asked that question, because hospitals are woefully underrepresented in their participation in this program. OSPAC recently had Mr. Michael Kubler from Providence, Portland, testify at one of our recent hearings about their recent award with the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, and in receiving $1.5 million, it was a very small portion of the retrofit work that they're doing in their facility, and it's one of the examples that we rely on in terms of seeking an appropriate time when the ceiling on that award level can be increased, so that it actually, for very complicated engineering situations, there's an adequate amount of money to make it worthwhile for facilities, not just hospitals, but for them to seek this award. Because in bigger facilities that have complex engineering situations and requirements, sometimes the level of effort that it takes to go in to compete for this grant almost makes it hard to justify the level of work involved for that little amount of money when there's a big target there. The other issue, certainly, for hospitals is in many small communities, these are such a critical component of those communities' welfare, especially in a disaster situation. We really would like to find more ways for those communities and their hospitals to bolster their ability to remain functional after a damaging earthquake. And that's whether we're talking about the offshore Cascadia subduction zone or somewhere like Lakeview in a rural setting as well. And so any way that we can improve the current funding for the program and the administration of the program's eligibility to get more hospitals involved would be supported.
Okay. So I have another question regarding this upgrades. And so is the intent in upgrading, well, obviously one is so the building doesn't fall down, but so what role in all of this, and how far do you go in relationship to saving lives, so the people that might be in the buildings versus just the building itself?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that question too, and it was briefly asked or discussed earlier. I think it's a complicated decision that communities have to make in terms of whether rehabilitating an old school or replacing it is the decision that they make. Certainly, this grant program is a rehabilitation program. And, you know, most schools were built prior to earthquake codes. Mm-hmm. And currently, most of the schools that I'm aware of are they're retrofitting to what's known as a life safety standard only, which is the minimum code standard to prevent collapse in an earthquake. But there's no guarantee that that school will be operable, and likely it would need to be torn down as a hazard building after the fact. The rehabilitation cost would be too much. And so the question that communities have to ask is whether the money they're investing in the retrofit is really getting them where they need to be. If they want a school that's going to be remain functional, if they want a school that's going to continue to perform as a shelter for them after an earthquake, relocating or certainly rebuilding a newer, stronger school may be a better use of their money. And in that regard, this program wouldn't fit the bill for them. And in pursuing resilience, it's a question that we're really trying to urge communities to ask themselves, because, tens of millions of dollars in retrofitting a school that may not provide long-term sustainable operation, it may not be the best use of their money if they have limited funds. We can't make that decision for them, but we certainly encourage them to make those considerations when they're going in that direction.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Lynn may need to come back up and answer this, or Jay, if you have the... I'm sitting here thinking there are probably a number of school buildings throughout Oregon that, because of age, location, a variety of reasons, the community would just, and the school board would just opt that it would not be wise to put seismic money into the facility, and it's better to look at a new option. And I think Lynn addressed this, but I want to clarify, because it would be neat if a community could step up to the plate and say, okay, that doesn't make sense. We need to find a different location and build a new facility and then raise that one. If they could use the grant from the seismic to help pass a bond to get the additional money to build new as seed money, because they would have been spending it frivolously otherwise, you know, it'd be neat for us to be able to reward a school district with some seed money for new construction if that were the decision made. Otherwise, we would have, as the state, sold bonds and paid the debt service for something that would be frivolous. And if a school district had that option to go, well, you know, if we had $1.5 million to go toward a new $15 million elementary school or whatever, then that would really be good seed money to go to the voters and say, we've already got this. But I assume that's not allowable by current law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, that's a great point, and it's something that has come up along those lines when we've discussed possible alternatives so that schools in tsunami zones can take advantage of the grant, because right now, technically, they can't apply for the grant program and rehabilitate a school that's located in the tsunami zone. And there's not been an eligibility for those schools because of that for them to take advantage of it. And one thing we've asked for consideration is, and I think it would have to happen by amending the constitutional language, is that those schools at least could apply for funds to offset their cost in order to demolish the existing school. So that they at least could offset that one cost if they're going to build a new school in a new location. That's not another factor that they would have to be responsible for. And the reason I use that example is because in Lincoln County, in Waldport, when they applied for a FEMA grant to demolish, to buy out and demolish a school in a tsunami zone, and then in their own money build a new one, in order for the FEMA grant to be awarded to them, they were restricted in the land use they could use for that school district anymore. It had to be open space. And I say this because if they weren't dependent on the FEMA grant in order to demolish the school, then they would still be able to reuse that space for their tax base instead of making it open space, and it wouldn't be a perceived penalty for the community. If the state rehabilitation grant program could find a way to at least provide eligibility for demolition costs to offset schools building new facilities, I think that would meet the need that you're asking for, at least in one avenue, so that schools would have an incentive to build a new structure instead of reinvesting money into, you know, dangerous old buildings. That's at least one take on one way to try and approach that.
And I believe Representative Evans or Representative Parrish actually had a bill to try to address being able to use, to change something, to use some of the funds to do it. At least we've had a conversation about that, and I thought there was a bill we tentatively talked about, but I don't remember.
I remember there being some bill that was initially discussed, or at least an amendment.
Amendment or something.
Had someone working on our behalf, and I think the decision was made that we were going to wait and try working through this option in maybe a much more integrated fashion so that it wasn't as haphazardly introduced. But nonetheless, OSPAC would be very interested in working with the grant program and with the legislature in finding a way to hopefully remedy this so that that money would be across the board applicable and not only restricted to reinvesting in old buildings that will not be usable after an earthquake.
So it appears to me that as you've talked about this and you talk about the choices communities have to make, there's a line there when we talk about human lives and safety, when you talk about what we might do. Even though the new school might seem to be the best long-term answer, the community still has to weigh the risk in the near term if something happens and they haven't made some minimal investments or that try to keep the building from falling down, of the risk to human lives of the school students. So it just doesn't, there's not a good trade-off or choice there sometimes. It's betting on it isn't going to happen for years versus it might happen right away.
Yes, it's definitely we're in a pickle. in the level of, the stakes are very high for all of our schools in our states that are still built way beyond any earthquake codes. Yeah. And I think we applaud the work that Dogami has done in order to have this assessment as a first step. We applaud the work that's been currently done in administrating the program, and we certainly applaud the efforts to consider raising the level of funding that is available just to alleviate this life safety issue for students who have to be in these buildings. And so, again, as our commission, we're here to provide advisement and support, certainly, for considerations of improving what we've already been doing.
So what year forward did we start requiring school buildings to be built to meet whatever the level of the standard for earthquake resistance is today?
Well, I don't think in Oregon we had an actual seismic code until the mid-1970s, and it's been revised incrementally over the years, oftentimes in reaction to earthquakes, and many times in California that our state has adopted building to. And in my opinion, after having been to Japan three times now since the earthquake and tsunami, and seeing the level of standards that they build to, I feel like in many ways we still have to institutionalize even higher codes yet than we're currently operating in our state.
Yeah, certainly.
For the seismic needs assessment,
why don't you go, just till you're on the record. So,
again, for the record, Ian Maiden with Dogami. For the seismic needs assessment, we made a decision that any building that had been constructed after 1994 was automatically considered low risk because it met codes that included the Cascadia subduction zone.
Okay, so 94, though, is where that's at. That's not that many years ago in relationship to the number of buildings we have.
Yeah.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you very much.
Appreciate
that, sure. Senator Boquist, do you have any advice for us? We've raised all the issues and the questions, so now we're looking for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, Chair of the Senate version of yourselves. I appreciate all of you taking the time to look at this issue. And I think if we go back to some of the first go-rounds when we did this in 2005, and Representative Escobar was there, and we started looking at some of these, and then some of you joined us. And one of the challenges that we have, and I think, Mr. Chair, you hit it on the head, and several of you said the prioritization here, is that we put all these restrictions on here, and we didn't do the study beforehand. And so now we're looking at, if you just think about, okay, how do you prioritize? And as you have the map, and you see where it is all right now. And, of course, the worst places are on the eastern side. There are no disrespect, Representative Huffman. They're over on your side. But it's also one of the areas that's, you know, at least less theoretically risk. Less risky versus being the north end of the San Andreas-type stuff in Lakeview area versus the coastal stuff and the other thing. And then at the same time, we said, okay, you have to rebuild if a school by standards out of the tsunami zone on the coast, but we're not going to give you any money to do that. And, of course, that is a problem. And so it kind of leaves us in a quandary. But I think Representative Hoffman raises a good point in some of the things that we might want to change the standard and how we address this and how we put money into the program to figure out the best way forward. Because, unfortunately, at the legislature, we do get to make those life decisions. We don't like to talk about that's what we did, but that's what we're doing. We're talking about now the discussion of, you know, reauthorization of GO bonds to $100 million or $200 million. And I always have to continue to remind my own committee members because they say, well, we can't do that now under the law. And it's like, did you look in the mirror this morning? We are the lawmakers. And I raise that issue because the discussion and there is predominant leadership members. We're all familiar with this argument going on that says, no, let's throw $200 million at this or $300 million at this. Let's not do the capital, so on and so forth. And so the mechanism out there to either, one, refer changes to the ballot now, I think still exists, mm-hmm. and to set a priority and say, what are we going to do in the prioritization. I look at the hospitals in a slightly different manner, and just to give you an example, because there are several medical facilities that are in tsunami zones that were in the private sector and were rebuilt right back in the tsunami zones. And they have a profit center, and so they can pay for that, so on and so forth like that. Our schools don't have that luxury. But then we're also looking in the capital construction budget here of a public institution that will be built, if it's funded under the capital construction budget this year, in a tsunami zone. And so I think there's a lot of latitude to move and move quickly. That the House is doing an informational hearing right now, you know, can easily translate into, for better word, part of the full meal deal or the deal that comes out of the, are we doing $200 million, what are we doing here, so on and so forth. And I would encourage that effort now rather than studying it, because I don't think some basic parameters, one, you should be able to rebuild, and even if it's seed money, use it as seed money. If that takes the Constitution, we should do that. We ought to be focusing on who's going to fall down first, that, you know, and since we know what that is now, and some basic parameters in here. And the reason I say now, we're very good at creating task forces in here. I don't know, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, how many task forces have you voted on in the last decade that we've been here? I can't.
A lot just since Evans came in.
Right, so there we go.
Yes.
And I think that's of critical importance, you know, to do something now. And I'll just point out to you the reason being is, as all the argument of why borrow now, for whether it's for this program or the capital or for a new building in OSU or whatever it is, it's blatantly obvious if you issue a bond, at least in the next few months or 6 months, the bond rate's going to be really good. Mm-hmm. However, I said as a vice chair of revenue finance, and so if you haven't looked at your revenue impact statements that are coming across in any bill you pass, go out to 17 and 19 and look at those impacts. What you're seeing is the cliff is coming. And even today, I think the almost verbatim statement from the state economist was, is we have a very aggressive forecast with exceptionally high risks, and you should consider saving your money instead of spending it, or at least put it off until February because of the risks associated with the revenue forecast. And the reason I say that is if we put this off and say, okay, let's not do anything, I will tell you we will not do it in 17-19 based on the dynamics that are out there right now. And we don't know. We could all be dead and in the grave before the big one happens, the Cascadia fault line or the San Andreas opens to 6 feet and it goes all the way to Lakeview and might even sneak over there to Medford, you know, and eat up a few people. But
I like it going to my house.
Yeah. So we're kind of in the place that, you know, despite it seems like the end of the session, there are moving parts out there, Mr. Chair. And I would say, as if, you know, we wanted to do something, it's still available to do because there are moving parts. The discussions are going about in these geo bonds of what their numbers are going to be, so on and so forth like that. And a few simple, even common sense referrals to the ballot of let's be able to tear it down, at least with this, or let's make it seed money for this, and let's give them statutory guidance that say, hey, look, you should start where the ground's going to shake the most, or where there's going to be the most injury, and go forward from there. Other than that, we are, in fact, going to, you know, those decisions aren't coming out of a policy committee, no disrespect to my colleagues, just slightly down the hall here, is when it comes to ways and means process, it's all going to be about money and bonds and how you did it. And then they'll come back 6 years later and say, well, why didn't we do it right back then? And, you know, they'll be very interesting because of the policy made in ways and means. And say, well, some policy committee didn't do this. And we're all going to be saying, well, that's because you took the policy away from us. But I would encourage action because it is doable to do that, at least not to send the ship in the right direction. Because if not, you have a whole host of places at risk. And as we all know, schools and public safety are the two areas that don't seem to be able to get bond or levies passed today. And I have no insight for questions, but of course I'm obligated to say we'll try to answer.
Yes, you are. Representative Huffman, please. But,
Senator Boqvist, you forget that you actually moved west to come and testify. Oh, yeah. So you're at the seat of the Magic Kingdom. tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon, this is the room for those discussions. Actually, last Friday afternoon, it was the GO, tomorrow afternoon's lottery. And since Representative Parrish came in, just for your future reference, we have a Representative Evans on this committee. He sits down at that end. Representative Parrish actually says that he is from the Task Force District, so, as his moniker. So he took Dembro's place when he moved to the Senate, being our task force person for the House.
Mr. Chair, I generally would not cross party lines to defend somebody, but I will just remind Representative Huffman that in your freshman year, you don't get to spend money.
Oh.
So it's all task forces.
That's right. Representative Perry.
Thank you. So I had a bill in another committee room, and then we had a member who had some issues that I went to go help them take care of, but so sorry for being late. Did I miss the part where you said you support bonding for the building, or you don't support bonding for the building?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, yes, you did miss both of those parts because I didn't commit to either one. I think the discussion really is if you're going to bond and go to a GO bond, then we need to establish a priority now, a decade later almost, that makes sense. And that is start where the worst place is. Some of that, in fact, because we decided we didn't have, pardon my French here, intestinal fortitude to do it all. We sent it out and did some stuff in the Constitution so that you have these constitutional bonding issues that are out there that we would have to send some changes out to the Constitution to make sure that we would have parameters to prioritize. I don't think it's an issue of, I mean, if you spend $100 million or $200 million and you're going to spend it, it's better to do it now than it is in 1715 because everybody knows, and you weren't here, we're not going to have it then. And the second thing is, though, if you are going to spend it, we need to make sure that it's prioritized because even though we are doing the best we can right now, we are blocked statutorily and constitutionally from doing the appropriate prioritization that needs to be done.
Thank you, follow-up.
Certainly.
So your French is nicer than mine. And so we had this sort of conversation 2 days ago, and I'm not personally interested in bonding the building, and I'm going to be, whatever that comes tucked into, I'm going to be a no. And I say that
you
not...
You say the building, you mean...
The Capitol. The Capitol. Yeah. The gold guy. And I say that because I don't think that any one building is sort of more important than another, and we can sit here and juxtapose kids versus legislators or whatever, and all sort of the media hay that makes. I actually... I'm interested in your opinion on a different approach, which is one where, you know, when my school district needs technology, we go out for a bond to do technology bonding, whether it's new computers or softwares or IT systems or whatever. And then we take those dollars and buy those things. And what I would like to see us have a real conversation about is taking bond dollars and bonding out, backing up our government somewhere in a redundant place so that if this building does fall or a courthouse in Tillamook County or whatever, that, you know, the legislature could operate out of a yurt in Bend, you know, somewhere where there wasn't an earthquake, as long as we can access our records and our data and you could have a quorum and get your, you know, your building. The building to me is sort of irrelevant if the building is, you know, going to be damaged anyway, and I can't get here. Who cares? It's like, if we can get to the data and the information and our records and the ability to turn government back on, that's a prioritization for me as a bonding request. And how I don't know how, because we've never had that conversation in the 5 years I've been on this committee. I don't know how much that would cost, but that is really a missing piece of how we would use bond money first and foremost, so that we know where all the, you know, the water mains are and the gas mains are in Tillamook, or, you know, we have their government records, and if Coffee Creek goes down, I'd like to know which people are the prisoners and which aren't, or, you know what I mean? So that feels like a first level of prioritization, and we're not having that conversation, and the conversation is, do we protect the gold guy and reinforce, you know, put some rebar or whatever in the building? I'd like your thoughts on that as... I feel like I'm sort of a lone voice in that conversation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, being the lone voice in the wilderness is like being a Navy guy who volunteered and ended up in Vietnam. So there's a lot of strange things that happened. I did not address the Capitol building in terms of deal. I mean, the problem you have here is it's interesting because from a public perspective of the building, just so you know, my good friend Nigel Jaquist, I'm using that as in an odd position, but printed this thing in the Willamette Week, and you know, I of course, like most politicians, except for you, Representative Parrish, I don't get to my own Facebook. My wife does my Facebook, right? So she published, you know, Nigel's thing on there about the Capitol diagram on there, and of course, I don't need to tell you that if I was doing a public opinion poll of, I don't know, the 100 and some posts I got back from that, almost all of them would be happy for you not to do it, and hopefully you're in session when it falls down. So I sort of reflect that. I mean, I'm unfortunately, for whomever, not really in favor of doing anything in this building at the time until such time we either address the critical infrastructure that we have that needs to be fixed. We know where some of those schools and public facilities are on the Oregon coast and in a few other places. That's the prioritization I'm talking about. The terms of here of I've actually gone down the road and looking of, you know, where is our electronical system backed up, how many times is it back up, so on and so forth. If you want to get into an SB 941 discussion and background checks, this is probably not the place to do it, because I do know what the background check, how this whole thing works and what the backups do. And I would point out that way beyond Representative Huffman, Mr. Chair's district out there, clear out on the far side around Burns, we have one of these another magical building with a bunch of backups of it out there. And I'm also the person, you know, that with Representative Cowan, who finally spearheaded the effort to convince one side that it wasn't a conspiracy to take over the government, and it was the other side to have a conspiracy to take over the government. And we passed legislation that said, constitutional legislation that says, when this building does fall down and the things do happen on the coast, we automatically go into session at the declaration, as I think you know. And then at that point, we make our way. And just for the record, I did sell that to the Republicans, that it was, in fact, a Democratic conspiracy, but the building would collapse on them, and we would be the ones left in charge because we'd be in rural Oregon. The answer to your question is that we do it. We have not done that. We haven't done it. And the question is, you know, what are those critical services? How do you back it up? Where's the government really going to be? I unfortunately had this discussion in the first week or so of the whole session with the good chair here. I had in my hand, showing before him, the business continuity plan that was last updated when Senator Verger and I co-chaired the committee in 2005. And if you'd like to know who the staff was and what the plan was in those days by name, it is dated 2005. I committed to the good representative that I would be working on that. My commitment stands just as soon as next Friday's last filing date happens, that we'll go back and try and start addressing those. The bottom line, you are correct, Representative Parrish, we have no plan. The written plan that we have took them a week plus to find, and that plan is dated 2005, and there is nothing in there that addresses a single one of the issues you're talking about. Nothing.
Another follow-up. So juxtapose the disaster management piece with, like, sort of the public records piece, so two universes I operate in. And it's sort of like a buy one, get one at that point. So you can get all your records somewhere where they're sortable and searchable and people can search them to their heart content, but then they're also safe and preserved and the light switch flips on. This Capitol's burned down twice already. It's had a fire, and it's also, and this particular building has already had a fire, and it's had a, it's been, you know, affected by an earthquake already. So, you know, anything we do to sort of try to reinforce it is only as good as the earthquake not, you know, sort of coming through Salem. So so what has spurred me on this is in trying to put together some of the pre legislative history before the last Capitol burned down. I mean, I said it the other day on Tuesday, committee room is eight. I mean, I'm trying to, like, buy some of our records back, and they're on eBay, and they're, you know, they're all over the place, sort of the original, like, pre-1935 records, and they're not housed here. So for me, and particularly now that we're digital, preserving the record and preserving the digital record, I think, is really important. But it'd be nice, because we'll have all these wonderful plans that this body helps create, and then, you know, you go down, but they're not anywhere anybody can get to them because everything's down. So to me, it's a level of prioritization that I don't think is happening in this building, is the notion of how do we make sure the light switch on in government, you know, the day after a disaster, which is agnostic of a building. I mean, you could do that. We could go convene in Idaho, potentially, or, you know, as farthest east corner of Oregon, as long as we had our information and the data and the processes, you know, we could always comes on. So I'd like to, I don't know how we steer the Senate president that direction, but but I think that's a very important missing piece of this conversation, and that's, I won't, until we see that come forward, I'm just not voting for a building.
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, well, I'm not voting for the building either, so. But
you said it. You're committed.
Relative to the present situation, I mean, one thing we have in government, because I think what was brought out in the earlier testimony when you guys were here is intriguing that people seem to forget, is we were sort of talking about the prioritization of medical facilities maybe on the coast and buildings on the coast. Once the earthquake happens or something happens, can you still shelter in that facility? And then the other question is, or do you need to have it against the health facility? So do you want to make sure you prioritize, if we do something, change the constitution statutory to prioritize education over hospitals, you're assuming then the building's not going to fall down and those children are going to be in that facility, and either some parents are going to be able to retrieve their children and take them home, or the reverse, for those of us old enough to remember this, the 1960s, or the parents are going to move to what used to be the old civil air raid shelter, so on and so forth, which used to be our schools. That is, for nothing else, a 24-hour function, and this should be keen in everybody's mind. We've spent $100 million, or on the way to spend $100 million. We're talking about spending another $100 or maybe another $200 million. This is a 24-hour function. So let me give you a real-world, Senator Haas, my boss in Revenue Finance, always, you know, they get done with the bean counting and the jacking of the jaws. Okay, now give me a real-world example. Here's what I'm talking about. We'll pick there was an example that was used, I think, in Toledo, Reedsport, something in that area over there. You built a new school, and the school is there, and it survives because you built that school. They got a FEMA grant, and the ground shakes, and now your children are in that school. Now, that is after, you guys all pick it are familiar, that's after the first couple of minutes, three or four aftershocks, so on and so forth. Now the question comes down, is Representative Parrish's question. Those kids, and I'm coming to this from the Committee of Doom and Gloom, those kids are now sitting there. Their parents may be two or three bridges away, which ODOT will tell you those will have to be repaired. The problem we face now is if it is as bad as we think it is, the center structure is gone, as you know, which means if it happens right now, we're gone. And those voters or those people tweeting on my Facebook think that's a good idea. But if we're not in session, all that stuff is gone. The problem we now have is even the emergency alternate location from here, which is the Renata Sanderson Center, which is public knowledge right down the wheel here, it is trapped too by the overpasses and everything else. We haven't got past in our work group how we're going to get a fuel truck to get to those old CIA generators that are out there that are going to power that thing for 24 hours. So we'll just assume that works. Now it's 48 hours later, and we're in the dark, and those school children are still sitting down there. And there is no effective plan other than wait for the feds to come help us. Now, we have plans and all the rest of that. But the whole dynamics here that we need to look at in this, unfortunately, is those school children that we saved down there that are down in Toledo, the only really effective way, and I've made this statement before, is I actually hope we're in session, and hopefully the building does not kill us all, because the only way we're going to survive any one of these events is that we are in session, we're here, and no disrespect, but all the lobbyists are here too, because we can hold them up in one room with 24 hours of power and call everybody. Everybody. And it'll be such that you'll be calling logging companies in Grand Round and saying, cut away to the coast. There is no environmental change. That might even take a week. And for those in the medical committees, you know what that means. At a week, how many of those kids are already going to be dead before you get there?
Well, and just the comment on the schools having run a lunch program, I mean, anymore with just-in-time type of delivery, it's not like they've got big giant storerooms of ways to feed those kids if they're locked there. I mean, and most grocery stores even nowadays don't hold more than 2 or 3 days of inventory at a time. So if you've got, in my community, for example, we're a weird little peninsula. There is no road basically out of West Lynn that you have to cross a bridge. You've got to, you know, whether it's Abernathy or Tualatin Bridge or, you know, bridge to get across. I mean, I'm surrounded by three rivers and a bridge over every one, and one maybe road out of the community, but it depends on where you live if you don't have to cross a bridge to get to that road. So, you know, three grocery stores or four grocery stores with a 2 to 3 day supply, and I've got 26,000 people in my town. Like, again, prioritization of a building, I want to know how government turns on the next day. And that's just regardless of a building. It's that type of planning that needs to happen. And, you know, We're not doing that level of planning.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, we're very, very ill-prepared as a state. Even my family, I can't seem to get them on the queue, because in Medford, we have a viaduct. And it'll fall, and when it does, we're cut off from half the city. We can't get from one side to the other side. So your government's on one side of the city, and the majority of the population is on the other side. It's just amazing to me. That, and we're very ill-prepared. But as for this building, I don't put much value in spending money at this time for this building. And the reason I say that is because of our children. Our children are our future, and your schools will be your centers of where people will congregate. But more importantly, we have some big shortfalls coming up here. And that is, we have $200 million to plus on the health care and a hole in the budget. Well, it could be as high as $1 billion. And then with the PERS from the Supreme Court, why would we want to borrow now with that kind of a hole? That's...
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar.
Doesn't make sense.
Are you talking about borrowing and bonding in terms of emergency preparation for schools and a reprioritization, or are you talking about the building here?
The building.
Well, once again, you're asking the wrong question. You know, if you'd like to direct those questions to either presiding officers, I'd be happy to. But in our chamber, quite respectfully, Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, whatever, I'm not going to answer that question. I don't have an answer. I can't help.
Representative Huffman, did you have a...
I thought the senator was going to respond to Representative Parrish the way he usually does. I'm sorry you're breaking up. I can't. You know, this is complicated. No offense to anybody. I enjoy the political posturing that goes on in this building as much as anybody. It's fun to sit back and watch. I don't get involved in it because I know that beyond the $300 million for schools versus the capital and all the stuff that's thrown out there, there are some real serious discussions underlying the political posture. I can build it bigger and better and spend more money on seismic than the Senate president or whatever. But underlying it all, we've got X number of dollars for bonding capacity that's recommended that we bond, roughly 965 in general obligation bonds, roughly 165 for lottery bonds. And what is the legislature's management responsibility of that bonding authority and for our general fund debt service obligation? If we spend all of the 965 plus 165, our debt service will be extremely reasonable by pretty much all standards. We'll be under 3.5% debt service based on the March revenue forecast. We were projected to be at about 3.5% if we spend that entire $1.152 billion, whatever it is. Is that responsible? I think the Debt Commission and everybody's trying to be responsible. And so then it gets into questions. One of my pet peeves has always been, and, you know, the folks that Nigel talked to about the article, were they all knowledgeable? I don't know. Is the 2,500 square foot... The new rooms that were talked about in the article in Willamette Week happen to be in the basement. How much of that would, and I don't have the answer to this, how much of that would have to be redone because so much of the work is going to be done in the basement and it's virtually going to be destroyed by the nature of the reconstruction. So maybe they're getting, reconfiguring and getting 3,000 square foot here in 20, I don't know. But I've been in this building working on Ways and Means long enough that I get really frustrated with state agencies and universities and community colleges coming in every biennium saying we need this amount of money for deferred maintenance. Mm-hmm. Now, how much of the $300 and some million on this building really needs to be done under the seismic deferred maintenance? How much of it's, you know, that's a serious question I think we need to address as a body. But it's a state-owned building, which this body has direct responsibility for. K-12 school buildings aren't. They're owned by the district and the community they're in. Now, do I forsake that obligation? No, I look at that like I have the responsibility we've taken up, the partnership we've taken up on county courthouses. Over the last two or three biennia, we've prioritized them, working with AOC and other partners to prioritize courthouses, and we're starting to do state and local government partnership on those. And I see us doing the same thing. We've been doing it with the seismic grant fund, and I see us continuing to do that, maybe expanding the seismic grant fund, maybe stepping up and doing what the facilities task force is asking for on the $125 million for new construction or remodeling or whatever that's necessary for school buildings. I'm going to advocate for, I'd like to see that number higher than $125 million also, because if schools aren't going to be able to take $1.5 million from seismic and build new as seed money, then let's kind of split the difference and fund both of them well as the state partnership. So I'm not opposing anything, but I'm just throwing out all these questions that I think as part of it's our fiduciary responsibility. Well, all of it's our fiduciary responsibility, and then part of it is our probable responsibility to our K-12 partners out there, that we technically, the legislature, and state funds, general obligation funds, don't have a direct responsibility for K-12 buildings, but I think there's enough agreement in the building, I sense it, that we probably will do something. Anyway, sorry to yawn on, but just wanted to throw out a lot of that.
Evans task force on it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, let me, because you asked the question and the chair can cut me off and throw me out anytime he wants to, that's perfectly fine. In fact, I'm was hoping he was going to do that about 10 minutes ago, but that's okay. Let me put my revenue finance hat back on. I mean, I did not ask to get put on revenue finance. I said I didn't want to do it, because the problem with being on revenue finance, if you get into the weeds, you find out, no disrespect, that you people that are in joint ways and means don't grasp what's about to happen. And I'm serious about this, because, I mean, I am the person a decade ago that said sequestration will come in, it will be permanent, these are the impacts, it's going to hit healthcare, so on and so forth across the board. And the lone staff person in this building from Legislative Revenue said, you better listen to what he's saying, and it all came true, and I'm going to say I'm right. But we're looking at a situation right now that the only opportunity to bond and bond responsibly, and $900 million is not responsible, I'll tell you that right now. We will not be able to pay it back. I know some of you want to do that, but just the numbers we're looking at from the revenue and finance and what we're going to act. Standard deviation is a $2 billion hit on the general fund. That doesn't include the health care and all the rest of the things you ways means people know what are going on too. The hit is going to be atrocious. The question comes back almost to the same question we have always had for a decade on veterans, and that is you can't get money for VSOs, veteran service officers. Why do we convince Ways and Means to get money for veteran service officers? Because once you get them on those benefits, they bring billions back into the state, and we can displace funds. It's the same argument we have that we're all living in a fantasy world, in my own personal opinion, is that in the education model, we're funding education. At some point, I mean, for those of you who didn't sit in some of those caucus meetings when he was not here, or before, as the previous governor, you know, figured out that you're going to have to consolidate. Whoever pays makes the golden rule. And the system that we have now is unsustainable. We all know that. So the question comes back down to the root of what we're talking about right here is what is a reasonable expenditure in emergency services funds, these grants? What schools should we save, and what critical pieces of infrastructure? Because once the building goes down, whoever's left in government is still responsible. If it's us, we're responsible for that little school in Toledo, even if it's 14 days later. And I hate to say this, and those with military background know what I'm saying here, it might be the only responsibility is we get there and we have to bury them. I hate to be that crass, but it is our responsibility as the state government to go to the FEMA is not going to help us. We're going to have to do that. So we have to set the prioritization. My only point, and I'm going to leave with here if you'll dismiss me, Chair, is that if we're going to do $100 or $200 million in bonding for this, for emergency stuff, and I think we almost have no choice but to do it. Certainly, it's eons or decades or stacks above anything in this building right here, is we need to reestablish the priorities so we know we're actually doing the right thing. Because we have put the handcuffs on these guys back here, and they can only do what the program says they can do. And I think everybody here knows we think the priority is different. We think the children that are closer to the earthquake zone, closer to the flood, or even closer to the forest fire danger are more important than the other ones, because we're going to inherit those people when the cities and the county governments fail. And if you don't think the cities and county governments are going to fail on the Oregon coast at a tsunami, you're probably in the wrong building, because it's going to be that draconian. With that, Mr. Chair, if you'll excuse me, we've talked, I think, more about the Emergency Services Act. They call us the Committees of Doom and Gloom, for those that are new to this, and I will return to my chamber, and please respectfully, all future questions on capital construction involving the state capital may be addressed to someone in the majority and in the leadership, and I am neither.
Thank you, Senator, for taking your time. I wish you weren't so reserved about speaking out about the issues. Do we all feel better?
I sort of knew his $2 billion budget hole is conservative. I think it's more like three, but who's counting at this point when we're,
Representative Evans, please.
First of all, I'm sorry for being late. I was at the Hmong Laos celebration. That said, the Senator and I have talked many times about his approach, and we share a background in having to think of worst case as a living. Having said that, there are some things, some bills that were introduced this session that we probably won't have the opportunity to move very far because of constraints, but I ask us to revisit, that are related to not the strategic 30,000-foot, 40,000-foot level, but closer to the 20,000-foot level, that are force multipliers. First, one of the things that he mentioned as far as the communities that will be isolated, one of the bills that we briefly talked about was looking at the prioritization process for certain state parks, certain county fairgrounds, certain public spaces that we can robust up with power, food, cached equipment, and the ability to be sustainable power, which will not be the perfect answer for anybody, but maybe a good enough answer for some in the wake of such a tragedy. The second piece is looking at how we do our armories. Federal law does not allow us to do some things with armories with federal dollars, but that does not mean we cannot do them with state dollars. And because they are a state function, and because in many communities they are spread out, that is a place, I think, for solid investment, not just for things that can be related to after an event in terms of crisis care, but one of the things that was brought up on Tuesday is as some of these communities get affected and some maybe not affected, you're still going to be having support troops and FEMA and federal aid coming in. So having places we can put some of the helpers even is an important piece. And then the third thing I'd just like to emphasize, and I don't want to beat this horse too much, but during the prior gubernatorial served tenure under Governor Kulongoski, Executive Order 0820 was put in place specifically to make sure that we were continuing to build the plan that still doesn't exist. And one of the things that I asked this, I think the real power of legislators on this committee is to not necessarily know what the right answer is, but to be asking the right questions, which I think we are, and to demand the executive to put time, effort, and treasure into figuring out what that plan is going to be. A flexible enough plan that we can do surge operations when necessary, that we can, as Representative Huffman talked about, help facilitate certain types of investments where we have shared responsibility, in some places where we have fixed responsibility, and have, in my opinion, an approach on certain types of assets. That's where we had the discussion about the bonding, for example, where we may be able to provide certain types of tools in regions that may not make a lot of sense in other parts of the state, but may make a lot of sense there on a lend-lease program, where after X number of years, that property becomes the community's, much like the UASI approach. I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about these types of issues, but I really hope that we can use the time in the interim, whatever we decide to do with this capital, but use the time in the interim to build some of those tactical level force multipliers when we come back in. Because just as the VSOs leverage federal dollars, I believe if we actually plussed up the Oregon Emergency Management with some of those regional support folks, they could also be looking at federal and private investment opportunities to bring into those counties to help local leaders with more options. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Representative Huffman.
I think the senator was probably saying something that I've been saying, the same thing, and Representative Parrish has been working on another angle of it too. But, you know, we see in the budgeting process more stress every biennium on having to backfill what the feds are no longer paying for. And I think that's part of what he was talking about on the demand on the budget. And he's absolutely right. You know, we see it every biennium, whether it's social programs, transportation, on and on and on, where we're having to come up with a billion here and a billion there to backfill. So I agree, we do need to be very responsible on what that debt service is that we're looking at. And but I will say that, you know, it shouldn't be 900 million, it's too high. But when you sit in all of the meetings and you go 100 million here, 100 million there, before you know it, you're at 3 billion. You're not at 900 million. So to say 900 million is too much and we can't afford it,
right?
Could be, but people need to stop asking.
Well, you know, if we just supported school choice and lifted the caps on online enrollment, we wouldn't have this problem about buildings.
So thank you for that.
And choice.
What I do think, though, and frankly, none of this, it's not, I think it's important to have the conversation, and let's be realistic about it, and I appreciate what you're saying. But I do think what we learned here today, and that I am concerned about even the near-term priorities, especially for the money that we're going to make available, whether it be made available to build a new school or that, and where that needs to be, because I think they're doing a great job with the program that they have, and we're addressing some of those, but we may not be addressing it from the priority standpoint of where the most impact might be in the near term. And I think, so I'm going to have a conversation with the speaker and see how we might, in a very quick time, have a little broader conversation about that and see if we could set something in direction. Because if some of it takes a constitutional change, then we need to act quicker rather than later to try to do those things.
You know, the other thing, I appreciate what Boquist had to say about, you know, going from the worst, we've seen those maps, you know, like the red's over here and it gets cooler as you go this way. But even then, that's a whole really interesting conversation about prioritization.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, I mean, you've got schools all up and down the coast. And
right.
And even if you had a half of, you know, $1 billion to bond, how does that get applied against the entire coastline? And that money is going to get sucked up really quick. And so I sort of tongue-in-cheek say online schools, but is it the schools that sort of need to be addressed, or are there places where we need to, like, emergency centers and state buildings, to John's point, you know, are there state buildings there that we need to reinforce as, you know, shelters and places where people can go get their kids if those schools go down? Because even if you had all the money you wanted to, you know, bond this session for seismic, then you have to go, whose school gets what? If we're invested in the schools, that's a decision that I'm uncomfortable making for a community that I don't live in, and you know, we're making really hard picks.
That's why you get the big bucks.
I know, get paid big bucks for that.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, one of the things that I think where the dollar goes the farthest in terms of mitigating seismic activity and events is a worthwhile discussion. However, one of the things that has to be decided, I think, in addition to discussions of formulaic or fairness in terms of where you invest the dollars in structures that already exist, is the difference between mitigation and prevention dollars and response and recovery dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would argue there's a place for certain types of buildings and certain types of activities to be reinforced and put our seismic investments in. But after that, you can't protect everything, so put money into response, whether it's a response to a terrorist event or a response to a natural event. The response and recovery phase are going to need certain types of investments that are actually a little different than trying to support every building that you can't necessarily anticipate. To me, the lesson of the Japanese tsunami that happened was that even with planning up to the 8.0 level, they weren't able to build it enough And it wasn't their fault. They did everything they could with the technology available. But I think we have to be very careful, and though, again, as Americans, we are always torn to want to protect and want to save that one person that's out there in, you know, the baby seal complex. We're trying to protect all of those. The issue is sometimes you have to make harsh choices where you put the dollars in, and I still believe that response recovery phase is probably at least as equal, if not more, of a logical investment. And that's not always going to be an easy sell.
No, it's not.
You actually have the money in the bank when the disaster happens.
Thank you all for that. And we will, as the Senator mentioned, we will get a chance soon to talk some about the continuity, the government continuity plan that hasn't been updated since 2005. They couldn't find it when I asked to look at it. And so that'll start some of the conversation you've been raising, Representative Parrish, about some of those issues. I mean, we just need to be doing increments on a lot of these things, but I appreciate the conversation, and we'll see how we can follow up. Representative Huffman.
You know, another thing where, you know, we all sit in different rooms, different times of the day. Occasionally we all come together, or some of us come together in different committees, whatever. But it's interesting. There's a member right now that's strongly opposing a project, economic development project in Cascade Locks.
Oh, no.
And I think about this, and I know that this the member that's opposing this project has not sat through any of our resilience conversations. No. And I'm thinking, do we really want to kill a water project in Cascade Locks that's going to be near east to the subduction zone, where they could be the most likely, quickest transporter of fresh water to the Portland metro area? So it's kind of like, I just, every chance I get, I like to ask members to, let's think it through before we send out a press release and make an announcement, jump on a bandwagon to oppose something. Is there a dot that we're missing that maybe really is an important key to connect? You know, anyway, not to name names.
But when you look at some of the disaster relief around the nation, when they have to truck water in, and when I was running for office the first time, I think I've said this before, you know, Mark gets a phone call. He's in the National Guard at the time, and he's like, I'm not coming home tonight. And I'm like, okay, because why? Well, I can't really, don't put it out there, please, but the town of Merrill's without water. You know, like their whole well went down, and they're, you know, for the entire community, and they were taking, you know, trucks, guard trucks that they had to fill somewhere with water to take it to the community. It took them a while to get them back up online. This was in 2010. And but when you look at who sort of becomes that deliverer of emergency, you know, bottles, I mean, a lot of times it's your bottle. I mean, your traditional bottle water companies, but beer companies. Anheuser-Busch has a can specifically that says, you know, they bottle water in a beer can, and, you know, for disaster relief, and they send it out on pallets, and that it's a critical and service, and it's not easy to trek water in from wherever you need it. So,
so I will just say, Representative Huffman, I agree. I don't think this process. This is the process we have. We have committees, we election every 2 hours. I don't think it lends itself very well for those conversations, but I wish it did, because I think those are important. We ought to be able to cross and have these conversations more broadly sometimes before we get put in the position and just making the decision without doing it. So I share, since I've been here, I have somewhat, I know, Pelosi is shaking her head. It is. It's just not, it's what it is, and to get the business done that we get done probably, but it's not the best long-term how we're going to do it.
It's adjourned. Before,
oh, no,
before
don't do that. Are you just leaving? Are you done? What happened? What did I miss?
We voted no on your bill.
Oh.
We said we're sending all seismic dollars to the coast.
That's right.
All seismic.
Anything else?
Thank you, Representative Bates.
Well, I hope your bill got out of the committee. So.
Well, we'll see. It was just a public hearing.
Okay.
Mine too. I wish they just worked those dark yields.
I know, isn't that the
question? It was
Lord,
this is Becker.
I know, it was Lord, this is Becker.
I know.